America is in trouble. We've turned our backs on God, forsaken our history, and too easily succumbed to tyrannical orders. Our problem seems overwhelming, but the solution is simple. It's time we return to the Lord in strict adherence to the Constitution of the United States.
Welcome to the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God. We're your hosts, Mark DeLuzio and Christy Tyrone. Now, let's get on with the show.
Welcome to the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God. My name is Mark DeLuzio with my co-host, Christy Tyrone. Hi, Christy. How are you doing today?
Hello, hello. Good, good. Ready to learn about the words today.
Yeah, make sure you talk right into that microphone, okay? We want to hear every word you say, okay? we are going to talk about words. Let me just set it up a little bit here. But words, you know, words do matter, to kind of coin a phrase, and or maybe steal a phrase. And one of the things, the whole essence of these words is critical to understand what these words meant in the Constitution when those words were written. Because words do have a way of changing meaning over time. We also, I think we talked about it in another episode, we'll probably talk about it again. People try to interpret the Constitution based on their interpretation today, not necessarily the intent of the founders when it was written. And you can't redefine the Constitution in that regard, okay? You have to be able to look at the Constitution as it was intended. And we have all kinds of documents to help us do that, like the Federalist Papers. We have all kinds of other, you know, notes and letters and documents and statements and all kinds of goodies out there that make it, if you want to do the work, and that's the work that Christy and I are going to be doing over the course of time, dig into these things and really find out what was meant by the Constitution and why it exists and why it was one of the greatest, if not greatest, you know, government documents ever created and long lasting. So Christy, you're gonna kind of pioneer this whole thing today with words. You've done a lot of work on it, and I'm going to turn it over to you and let's hear what you have to say.
All right. So we're going to talk about why words matter. And like Mark said, we really want to, being the Constitution Solution, we want to talk about why words matter when we're discussing our U.S. Constitution. This is really going to focus on Noah Webster, one of our founding fathers. Though he was not in the government, his outside influence was huge in shaping our Constitution, and his life's work was all related to words and kind of capturing the American language in a way that would preserve the intent of our founding. So we're going to talk about all the things he did and how and why that matters. And in that, we're going to kind of cover why words matter to God, why words matter to our founders, and why words should matter to us today. So, and in that, like I said, we're going to go over the background of the 1828 American Dictionary of the English Language, which was Noah Webster's life work, and why that book specifically is relevant to us today while striving to preserve our Constitution.
Christy, no, so, question for you. Noah Webster, first of all, he was a big government guy, right? He was not one of the, what we'd call Federalists like Thomas Jefferson was or Madison. He was more along the lines of a Hamilton and a John Adams, if you will. But he had the foresight, though, to say, hey, we got to get our words. Because think about this. 1776, Constitution 1887. This dictionary is 1828. So, you know, it's almost 50 years or so later from our revolution. And so he had I've got to believe words somehow changed then too, although probably slower than they do today because there's no internet, there's no, you know, that type of thing. So, but he had the foresight, you're saying, that to look ahead and say, hey, we got to make sure people understand these words today. And then the other mind-boggling thing about this is no internet. He did this all manually. I mean, guy was brilliant. Absolutely.
Well, and one of the things that he was concerned about was, well, he knew that changing the Constitution would be hard to do because, you know, the process is pretty intense.
Right.
So he figured that anybody who wanted to play dirty would, instead of taking the time to ratify a new amendment, they could just change the meaning of the words
That doesn't, that would never happen. Come on. We'd never change the definition of a vaccine. Come on. Give me a break. I'm sorry. I couldn't resist.
It is. And that's why we're talking about this, because everything changes faster with the internet and all our communication that we have now. So the meaning of words is getting blurrier and blurrier. So, okay. And preserving intent is one of the great ways we can save our country. So let's talk about why words matter to God. Our God is one who speaks. The Gospel of John starts with, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. There's examples of God speaking to his people all throughout the Bible. In the garden, he hangs out with Adam and Eve on Mount Sinai. He talks to Moses and, you know, gives him the Ten Commandments. He speaks through the prophets as things go on. Jesus came to earth and preached in the flesh, and all the prophecies, Jesus put all the prophecies to light and fulfilled them. So it was like these were the written things that he brought to life. And then when the apostles went on to write all the epistles that we read today, and even in those, they reference the old, as it is written, is often said by the apostles, because the word mattered to them. And then, so all these stories are compiled in the Bible, just representing the word of God is one of the most powerful. The sword of the spirit is the word of God. And so in that, we can talk a little bit about, you know, Bible history and the different manuscripts and the languages it was written in. And I know you've looked into a little bit of that too. It's fascinating when you get into not just Bible study, but studying the Bible and the history of it.
Yeah, different Bible study is, okay, what does the Bible mean? What is the word of God and all that? Studying the Bible and how it all was. Well, again, and when we say the Bible, there's so many different versions, as you pointed out in last time we were together, and just understanding how all of that came to be today, right? Not only the King James Bible that's popular today in the in Christianity, but all the other types of Bibles and interpretations, and as you indicated, different languages, right? I mean, that puts another complexity into the equation in terms of interpreting from one to another, you know, so it's fascinating how it all came together.
It is, like, there's some words that were, you know, written in the Greek manuscripts that, like, we don't have an English word that fits that, so they just would, you know, as a transcribing, they'd have to kind of figure out, like, how do we explain that, you know?
That's right.
And I know there are some people that think, like, oh, the Bible was just written by a bunch of men and it's changed and it's shifted over time, so they kind of discount the viability of it.
Are these the same people, by the way, that don't know what gender they are? I'm sorry. Again, I digress. I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. Okay. So,
so it's pretty amazing when you kind of look, and I haven't dug deep into this, but just, you know, a little brief research, you see that, you know, there's 66 books in the Bible written by over 40 authors and from different continents, different time. It's like a 1500 year time span. And these people not only were writing without specifically always knowing what was going on in the other place of the world, and the story still relates, but through all the translations and through all these separate scrolls that were pieced together to make the canon, were the errors or verses in question are minuscule. I think it's in the high 90% accurate. And so to think of humankind being so straightforward and true in anything for that amount of time, it shows that it's not just humans that did it. This was a work of God. This was God's will to preserve his word for us to have for our existence here.
Well, so that's a great point, because people say, oh yeah, well, you know, man created the Bible, so it's imperfect. Well, wait a minute. Man is a reflection of and a creation of God. So how could you say God did not create that Bible if you think about it, right? So
he put it together. He put it together, and it's pretty amazing how reliable and true it is, considering, you know, all the variables that went into making it. So So as Christians, our life work is to share the gospel. And for patriotic Christians like us, the most important reason to keep America strong and free is to protect our freedom of religion and freedom of speech so that we can freely share the gospel and God's word with our fellow citizens and even the whole world. So that's, to me, to you, to most of us, that is the most important fight in keeping America free. So then we can move on to why words mattered to our founders. These guys understood that the sovereignty of thought is the most valuable of all private property. And that's why freedom of speech and religion is the First Amendment. And freedom of press is in that too, right? And the right to assemble. And you look at all the things in the First Amendment, and they're different ways of expressing our sovereignty of thought. And that was a really big deal to these guys, because you figure at the time when they were ruled by England, pastors had to send their sermons to England to be certified to say, oh, you can teach that to your people. Street preaching wasn't really a thing. You had to like stay in your church.
Isn't that what happens today with the press? The press sends their newscast to the DNC, let's say, and I'm sorry. I keep digressing here. There's a lot of parallels, okay? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It all connects. That's why we're doing this. Well, and then I guess this kind of goes back to the Bible stuff, but like it was the Geneva Bible that that the pilgrims brought over, that version later made into the King James Bible. And the King James didn't like the quote seditious footnotes at the bottom of the Geneva. So he cleared that up and made really wide margins. So there was no room to write, you know, what you thought about it. But King James did make a straightforward, like unified print, because Geneva had a lot of different ways of saying things. But I think that the founders couldn't print Bibles in America at first. You had to get them from England. And I know there's some cool stories about smuggling Bibles over during this era, but I haven't studied those yet, but I heard about that. I'm like, oh, I can't wait to learn about that part of it. But so preserving the word of God was their main thing. And they built their whole society on the word of God at the time, the pilgrims and whatnot. And so once we, you know, declared independence and became our own nation, that was like the top thing. Like, we have to preserve this, right? And colonial America was one of the most literate societies of all time, which is pretty cool when you think about that. And it's because families were reading their Bibles together. And we know what we know about our founding era, it was through the written word and letters that family members wrote to each other and their journal entries. That's how people communicated back then. You know, you weren't video chatting or, you know, checking in on the Facebook or even, you know, watching the news. We didn't have any of that technology, but yet people were super connected by the written word. And a lot of what we know about the Revolutionary War period is through John and Abigail Adams' letters to each other, because they were separate for a lot of it, because he was out, you know, building the new nation and, you know, ambassadoring in France. And so they kept in touch. And Abigail Adams actually taught herself to read and write. And she was actually kind of self-conscious about it, I guess, because she didn't think she did it well enough. Like, she'd probably be horrified to hear that we're all reading her letters to John now. But she, I think, was kind of hard on herself, but that makes for a good student, you know, when you want to get that stuff right.
Yeah, when you're hard on yourself in that regard and you're more humble, you're, this makes you better. And she's probably a lot better than she thought she was. So,
for real, she's actually kind of noted for her skill with words as a woman at the time, a self-educated woman at the time.
Yeah.
Then Sam Adams was another of our founders who was really hot with the word, and he was, you know, kind of a master of propaganda, you could almost say, at the time, because he would take a situation and flame everybody on it. Like, look at this, and this happened. And he would really get people interested in what was happening in Boston by writing to other colonies and making sure that people knew what was happening here. And what do they say? Sam Adams wrote the postcards, and John Hancock paid the postage. So they were kind of a team that way.
You know, it's
but
funny.
it was
You
the
know,
words.
You say it's a team, right? I was walking through Boston one day, one fall day, and I see this little cemetery. It comes out of nowhere. Right in the middle of Boston, right? I look over. It's John Hancock and Sam Adams' graves. Side by side. Together, yeah.
I need to go there. That's
yeah,
like,
and it's like
high on my list.
Wow, that's cool. You know, so. So when you say they were a team, they're still a team.
Yeah, they're still a team. Cool. John Dickinson is another guy who's kind of less talked about, but he has these letters from a farmer that he wrote as a compilation of essays that he wrote during, like, from the Stamp Act and on, about our God-given liberties. And his take was really cool, and it's really inspiring to read his letters. Then, of course, there's Thomas Jefferson, you know, and that guy's way with words. If you know, when you read his journals, like, it's mind blowing the stuff this guy was pondering and thinking about, and the way that he wrote. Well, he's the main author of the Declaration of Independence, which is unbelievably epic with words.
He was a stud with the pen, let me tell you. And the Declaration, they say, is I don't know how to say it. One of the most brilliant literary pieces.
There you go.
They say next to Shakespeare type of thing. And the way he wrote that, and how he used words, and phenomenal, phenomenal. You know,
it really is.
I wonder why he didn't write the. We got to dig into that. Why he didn't write the Constitution? James Madison wrote most of it, and I mean, they all had their 2 cents to put in, but Madison was a primary author of the Constitution. And,
I think Jefferson was in France during all that. He went to France for a while. So I don't think he was like.
Was that what it was? Yeah, because, and by the way, no quarrel with Madison either. Okay.
Yeah, so he did good.
Pretty darn good, right? I mean.
He's good. It's very straightforward kind of good. But Jefferson is just like I said, mind blowing, almost poetic, you know. It's
well,
totally
straightforward.
Different style of writing.
Christy, we did this on another podcast. What was it, 4,200 or so? 4,200 or 4,300 words, the whole Constitution, the whole thing.
Yeah, get it to the point, right?
4,300 words, you know, that's nothing. That's nothing. The book is so thin. If you can't take time to read the Constitution, then you get off of Amazon, because it takes less time than that. Okay.
I'll say with that too, being an author, you know, and I write the historical fiction books, and I can write a whole 100,000 word story kind of no problem. But when it comes to writing the back cover, the summary on the back cover, where you have to get the whole story into 180 words, you know, getting people captivated without giving too much away, that is harder than writing the whole book.
It is hard.
And so when you look at like something like our Constitution that is relatively super short, but so impactful, getting the biggest impact out of the fewest amount of words, like, they nailed it there. So of all of our founders and their knack for words, there's one who we might even say was obsessed with words. And that's our guy today that we're going to talk about, is Noah Webster. He was born in West Hartford, Connecticut in 1758. So he was just like a boy, maybe 7 or 8, when the Stamp Act Rebellion happened.
No, when I got married, Christy, we lived in West Hartford for 5 years, but I did not know, him. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So,
You weren't there for the Stamp Act, just shortly after.
Yeah, just a little bit afterwards, right? Although I've been to his house. I told you I've been to his house. It's on South Main Street in West Hartford. Little red kind of cape type of house. And you get to go in for free. You just walk in, and they got a lady sitting there, and you know, and they have his original dictionary there in under glass. It's really awesome to see. Yeah. It's
that is a cool piece of history.
Kind of cool, yeah. Yeah. So anyway.
That's really cool. Thanks for sharing that. So Noah was just a boy during the Stamp Act Rebellion, but his parents were were part of the boycotts, and they were resisting the king's tyranny at the time. So he saw that. He saw his parents making that stand just as a kid. And then his father, like most colonial men, he was also Noah Senior, He was a strong Christian man, like most of the guys back then, and he led his family to Christ through regular church attendance, at-home Bible studying, and meaningful conversation with his children. And even as a kid, Noah was like super into like having these deep and meaningful conversations with his father and really like pondering the meaning of life and God's work and everything, even at a young age. He was always, Noah Jr. was always a deep thinker, overanalyzer, and a highly dedicated achiever. So he was a young man when the war encroached, and he was ready to stand at arms to defend his homeland. But he didn't get called to service, though he would have, with his heart overflowing with patriotism. He loved his country. We'll say homeland, because at the time the country was England, right? But when it came time to declare independence, he was all in. So even though he didn't call into service, he continued keeping up to date with what was going on during the war. But he went on to with his education and became a schoolmaster. The books he used to teach were printed in England at the time. Like I was saying, like about the Bible, England had strong control over the printing of books. And so these things that he was using to teach these school children were all about King George, and they were like, you know, his majesty and kind of the ways of old, I guess you could say. And so Noah thought that we should have American books teaching about our heritage and our geography. So he started writing them. We say that you don't like what's going on. You wish this existed. Well, then do it, make it happen. Right. So Noah did that. And then, so as he wrote these books with a more American based education, his pushy and almost cocky demeanor led him across the states on horseback to sell these books. And he would like go into bookstores and say, "Hey, you know, you want to sell my book?" And if they weren't a bookstore, just like a regular market, he'd be like, "Hey, do you guys sell books?" "No, you should." So he got his books out into the world that way. And then eventually he used his way with words to charm his way into the good graces of General George Washington and Benjamin Franklin. And so, like I said earlier, though he wasn't part of, like, in the House, you know, at the Constitutional Convention, he was not part of the government as a servant, but he, as a citizen, was super invested in what was going on. And when it came time to, you know, create the Constitution, he was a strong proponent and outside influencer. He would kind of like hunt down Benjamin Franklin afterwards and be like, "Hey, what went on in there today? What were you guys working on? What do you think about this? And maybe we should add some of that." And so,
yeah, no, Christy, we have to have episodes on each one of these characters, because each one by themselves was fascinating. You know, you're talking about Noah Webster, Ben Franklin. I mean, geez. The things that he didn't do, that'd be a shorter episode than the things he did do. He was a scientist. He was a philosopher. Go down the list, right? His biggest claim to fame, though, and I don't know if you know this or not, is he invented the granny claw. He had a brother my mother had one. It's a little claw that you can reach up on top of the shelf and pull something down. Has a handle on it. He invented that because his brother was paralyzed and he wanted to help his brother be able to reach things. And he invented the granny claw, which is, like, to me, that's like the biggest contribution he made to this country. So
he made all of the, I keep learning more things that he invented.
Oh, no, he was off the charts, one of a kind. Yeah.
So it would be kind of fun to do little profile episodes on some of these.
We should do that. We should do on each one of these people. They're fascinated in their own right. So, yeah.
Well, and it is. And it's cool when you kind of learn about them as people. Because then it's more relatable, and you do see their flaws. They all had their flaws. It's not like, you know, they were these perfect men that got together and made this, you know, unquestionable, you know, form of government. It's like these guys were all, you know, good men, but also messed up like the rest of us.
But it's,
you know,
interesting how we want to hold all of our elected officials today to a perfected state, and then look at their own lives, the people who are on their moral white horses. And it's like, really? Okay. If you can't do it, man is imperfect. Well, and that's the beauty about the founders knew that. So
they knew that. That's what did Madison say? If men were angels, we wouldn't need government, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
So Noah Webster was late to find love and start his family, but even with them in tow, he kept heavily involved in the ongoings of our newly formed government. And in that process, I want to share with you guys a few of his accomplishments. So one of the things he really worked on was he wanted a standardized language, because at the time, things were not unified. You would just kind of spell things how they sounded. So even people's names would be spelt differently from different letters or documents. I've actually kind of had a hard time with that while I'm researching to write my stories. Because, like, for example, Christopher Cedar, he was one of the first fatalities of the revolution. He's an 11-year-old boy, and that's a really sad story. But in different articles and, like, broadsides and prints about it, his last name is spelled different. S-Y-S-I-C-I, you know. And so I'm like, is this even the same person, you know, as I'm going through it? And then, so Noah wanted to fix that. He wanted to make sure that things were spelled that we all were kind of unified in our language. Another example is like the Liberty Bell. Pennsylvania is spelt with, I think, one N on the Liberty Bell.
Did you ever see the Liberty Bell in person?
I have not.
Yeah, we did. We took the kids there when they were young and did the whole Philadelphia thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And when we saw the Liberty Bell, I tell you right now, Christy, it just wasn't what it was cracked up to be. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. You give me an opening, I'm going to take it, okay? Yeah. So
I like that.
that would be a trip though if you can survive the crime in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Go through Philadelphia and see all the state house and all the other things that are there. It's phenomenal. So Franklin's grave is right there. I mean, I remember standing over it and saying, "Wow, I'm standing over greatness here," you know. So
isn't it so sad that like the place where, you know, independence was born is such a mess now?
Subject for another day.
Yeah. So like the Liberty Bell, that's not all it's cracked up to be. The Pennsylvania is spelled with one N, I think, on there, which I think in the Constitution, Pennsylvania is also spelled with one N.
I think a so. Few of the, yeah. It's spelled wrong.
There's a few spelling errors in our founding documents. If you look, like insure, I think in the preamble is spelled differently. And so it just wasn't like a priority to be consistent in our spelling. So that's something Noah pushed for. And he thought that we would be a stronger nation if we were connected by a common spelling habits, which is kind of a funny thing that no one else is really thinking about that. And so one of the ways that he worked to do that was he created the Blueback Speller. And so it's a little book that teaches children how to spell and write and read. Anza and I got a copy of it, and so we just kind of started looking through it. It's definitely for younger children, but it's pretty neat to have and see what these people were working with as they got this book. And it has little, you know, lessons of good morals and things about our country and patriotism in there. So as they're learning to read and write, they're learning to love our country. And I thought it was extra cool to find out that when westward expansion started off, people would go across the country with their Holy Bible and their Blueback Speller. So no matter where you lived or out on a homestead in the middle of nowhere, if you were far from town, no schoolhouse nearby, you know, no library for sure, you still were connected to your family in the East by a common language. You were speaking the same way, writing the same language, and keeping connected through a common language. So that,
you know,
was
Christy, when I learned about the Blueback Speller, I didn't know about the Blueback Speller until, you know, you did your research. Okay. But speaking of West Hartford, Connecticut, they renovated their downtown area into this unbelievable, you know, restaurants and shopping and phenomenal. They did a phenomenal rejuvenation of that area. And they call it Blueback Square.
Cool.
And I always wondered when I was living in Connecticut, like, what does that mean, Blueback Square? But I never bothered to really look, right, and find out. But they call it Blueback Square. And that's kind of a neat trivia question. When I go back there, I can ask people and, like, sound really smart, you know.
Yeah, you knew that, right?
Yeah, I knew that all along, of course. Yeah. Noah told me. But, you know, it's kind of neat, right, that they named it that.
That's
so
really cool.
They didn't forget their history, which is good.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
History is so fun when you start making these connections.
Oh, yeah.
So throughout all of this, Noah's greatest work was writing this dictionary. And he spent a very long time working on it, word for word, this and that. He got a lot of criticism on the ways. And he was even trying to do, like, kind of would release little parts of it and stuff, and like medical terms he wanted, you know, thought those should be more unified, and people were like, you're not a doctor, you know. So he got a lot of criticism on the way, but he kept going. And so, like I said, it wasn't until 1828 that the dictionary finally came out, which is much later than, you know, declaring independence, getting through the war, writing the Constitution. But it happened. He did it. And it is a wonderful thing to have around. And then all of his, summing up this kind of part about his accomplishments, but we'll get more into the dictionary in a bit. But all of Noah Webster's work was bonded to the Bible. And this is a quote that he said about it all that I think is super cool and wanted to share with everybody. He said, Noah Webster said, education is useless without the Bible. The Bible was America's basic textbook in all fields. God's word contained in the Bible has furnished all necessary rules to direct our conduct.
Powerful.
Pretty cool stuff right there.
Yeah, powerful. That's, you know,
nation shaping stuff.
Well, you know, I think you think about what he did, right? And just how hard that was to do. And it wasn't like he put 20 words together, okay? I mean, it was pretty exhaustive, right? And to have the foresight and also the energy and, you know, conscientiousness to put this thing together is phenomenal. And I got to believe that the 1828 dictionary by Webster is, I've got to believe, and I'm not a lawyer, but I've got to believe it's used as a source document for courts, for Supreme Court, you know, to go back and find out, like, you know, the types of, we'll talk about some words in a few minutes, mm-hmm. but, you know, I've got to believe that's got to be a key document. Just like the Federalist Papers are the same. Right. And let's not forget that at the time of our signing of the Constitution, the nation at the time was some 95% Christian, I believe.
Yeah, we're dealing with a different.
It was up there. It was up there, right? So anyway, but anyway, yeah, powerful stuff.
So let's talk about why words should matter to us today. Mm-hmm. And I guess we'll call them the left. There's a strong abuse of power happening through vocabulary. And in our government right now. And so Mark and I kind of want to go over some of the examples of how vocabulary is being abused these days. Sometimes it's twisted to shape a narrative. Sometimes things are omitted to shape the narrative. And so it's a very powerful tool, and the wreckage is uncountable in times. One of the things I'll just say right off the bat that on the terms of omitting, recently, Kamala Harris was speaking to a pro-abortion, you know, pro-death group of people, and she quoted the Declaration of Independence, but she omitted two very important words. She said, "We are endowed," left out creator. "We are endowed with certain unalienable rights. Among these are." She left out life. "Among these are liberty and the pursuit of happiness." She left out creator and she left out life. Those are massive terms in there that really like are the bedrock and foundation of our country. And she just left them out. So that was one of the most recent, I think, examples of the egregious omission.
I have so many comments about that, but I'll just let that speak for itself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I know you have a few others, Mark, that you've noticed that people have used to abusing our vocabulary. If you want to share them,
well, you know, one of the ones is this whole thing about marriage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at today's dictionary, it doesn't say anything about man and wife. I got to believe Webster's did in 1828, anyway. Yes. A man and a woman, I should say. It says today the Webster. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary.
That's the one online, yeah? Are you looking at the
internet? The one online said, yes. The state of being united as spouses in a consensual and contractual relationship recognized by law. And it goes on, the mutual relation of married persons, wedlock. the institution worn by individuals joined in a marriage, the act of marrying, or the rite by which the married status is affected, especially the wedding ceremony and attendant festivities. It goes on and on, right? An intimate or close union. Okay, so it doesn't talk about the traditional reason that you might find, I would believe, in, I don't know if you have that there, Christy, or not. Do you have, you do? Okay, so you have what Webster said about marriage back then.
I have the Webster definition. And I know, I'll just say too, because there's so many online dictionaries, some of them even say like whoever, like, you know, whatever sex is, whatever people, like, you know, it's definitely not limited to just a man and a woman in the online dictionary. Okay, so marriage, as according to Noah Webster in 1828, and it's not just Noah Webster, this is the time, these definitions just really encapsulate the meaning of words in that era and really go to show where the hearts and heads were of the people at the time. So marriage is the act of uniting a man and a woman for life. Wedlock, the legal union of a man and woman for life. Marriage is a contract, both civil and religious, by which the parties engage to live together in mutual affection and fidelity till death shall separate them. Marriage was instituted by God himself for the purpose of preventing the promiscuous intercourse of the sexes, for promoting domestic felicity, and for securing the maintenance and education of children. And then it goes on and it quotes some Bible verses to back all that up.
I think somewhere along the line that got changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, and okay, so that's a good example of how things, you know, transition over the course of time.
Well, and I think like marriage is not a word that we'll see in the Constitution, but it is the bedrock of all society. So the difference in what you find online as compared to in this dictionary is a really striking contrast of the outlook of society from the core on out.
Well, you know, there's a lot of misinterpretations in the Constitution, and one of the things we're going to talk about on another episode is the different clauses of the Constitution, like the welfare clause. And the welfare clause has been totally misconstrued as being charity.
Well, okay. And then I looked that one up, and mm-hmm. then we'll share this comparison of definitions right now, too. I looked welfare up online and the Merriam-Webster dictionary. Mind you, Noah would probably flip over in his grave and yell at everybody if he knew they were doing this with words under his name. So in this online dictionary, it says welfare, the state of doing well, especially in respect to good fortune, happiness, well-being, or prosperity. That's the first definition. And then the second says aid in the form of money or necessities for those in need. And then an agency or program through which such aid is distributed, of relating to or concerned with welfare, and especially with improvement of the welfare of disadvantaged social groups, receiving public welfare benefits. There you have it.
You know, as I think we talked about this in another episode, but the founders were adamant that the federal government was not about charity. Matter of fact, they even came out, I think it was, I don't know if it was Adams or Madison. We have a quote in one of our episodes of that. They're adamant that protection of your personal property is key, and to take money from party A and give it to party B means that the government has control over both of you. And that's not what the essence of this Constitution was about. And it was a protection of your personal property. And you'll look at the government today, and the federal government, I should say, is 60, maybe 70% transfer payments. Mm-hmm. So you want to talk about words. Here's a word for you, entitlements. That's a great word that's been thrown out as a unbelievable marketing term that basically says you're entitled to my money. Mm-hmm. No, you're not. No, you're not. You're not entitled to my money. And but that is a word now, and it's in that you look at the budget of the United States and it will have the word entitlement in there. you're not entitled to my money. You can't, you know, to Biden's tuition reimbursement, taking money from one, getting paying off their tuition to another. There's so many unconstitutional things about that. Besides the fact that, you know, the executive branch can't do that, that they can't spend, they don't have the power of the purse, that's Congress, but it's a non-constitutional spend to begin with. So that was the thing that everybody got outraged about. And at the end of the day, there are so many other examples of that, but they picked
them out. Those all fit under this current definition that I just read you.
That's right.
Welfare is.
That's right.
And they'll take that in the general welfare clause, right? Let's look at what the Webster.
And by the way, the general welfare, as we talked about, the general welfare clause was the welfare of the nation, not of an individual. But we talked about that in another episode. Yes.
But I think you'll like this 1828 definition much better, Mark, I'm sure. So let's see.
I'll sleep at night.
It says exemption, welfare, exemption from misfortune, sickness, calamity, or evil, the enjoyment of health and the common blessing of life, prosperity, happiness, applied to persons. Definition two says exemption from any unusual evil or calamity, the enjoyment of peace and prosperity, or the ordinary blessings of society and civil government, applied to states.
So yeah, there you go.
To the states, it says right here. Yeah. Yeah. It was never the intention of our federal government.
Of the nation, of the states, not of John and Mary Smith, right?
Exactly.
That's exactly right. Well, you know, there's some other ones too. I'll just go through some real quick. You know, I would say they maybe the meanings maybe haven't changed. Some of these words might not have even existed, but just to see how words are used to misrepresent what the underlying premise is all about. So, for example, progressives. The true definition of a progressive, going back to Woodrow Wilson, who's the father of progressive movement, is they just don't believe in the Constitution. They're not progressive at all. They just don't believe in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. But when you hear that word, you say, wow, progressive. Yeah, they're really trying to be cutting edge here, right? Yeah. Okay, cutting edge right into communism. You get things like Affordable Care Act. There was nothing affordable about it, and there was no care involved. Care got worse. But that's what they named it. My favorite one is earned income credit, how they use that, because it's like, okay, if you're not familiar with that, doing taxes, if you don't earn any money, you get a check from the government. So where exactly did you earn it if you didn't work? Okay. But an earned income credit is what they title it. Social Security is a phenomenal one as an example. Well, they got the social part right, because it is socialism. And the government, I hate to say this, but the government should never have put that in, because look at the enumerated powers. We talked about this before. But security. Where is the security in Social Security? Anybody try to retire on Social Security? This is an interesting one. The right to bear arms. Okay. Bear has been proven. I think Justice Scalia was the one that really went through this. Bear means... back then means handheld.
So the right,
you should be able to have own a weapon that's handheld. So all of the banning of weapons, like automatic guns, okay, certain type of semi-automatics like AR-15s, although, you know, and then going right with that, look at the words are used there, assault weapons.
Yeah.
You know, I could take the most benign handgun, a low power 22, and if I shoot you with it, that's an assault. I'm sorry. You're going to die. You know, so how they ban that, how they use these words, fair share, ignoring the fact that 50% of our taxes are paid by the upper 2% of income earners and the lower 50% zero. Fair share. I mean, woman's right to choose. Separation of church and state, which we'll have a whole another episode on someday. You know, all these things are used to misconstrue. So it's not only that the words have changed definitions, but we're using perfectly good words to just twist the meanings of what's really going on, which is why I always say you cannot trust the government. You always have to, you can't, I don't care who's in office, I don't care what party you are, you cannot trust the government. And that's why we have to be vigilant on holding our elected officials accountable. And that's exactly why Christy and I are doing this podcast, so that people can understand what their rights are. And we're going to get into one of these called nullification next in another episode, but what their rights are, and not accept these words at face value. Okay.
And exactly. And
so, you know, so there's so many other examples, Christy. I'll stop there. Okay. But there's so many other examples that we could look at here. And it's upon us as citizens to be informed, to really understand what's going on. And having that 1828 dictionary, by the way, in your bookcase is really key if you want to get serious about this.
It really is. And there's a quote by Jefferson about this very thing, about understanding the intent of our founding here, where he says, on every question of construction of the Constitution, let us carry ourselves back to the time when the Constitution was adopted. Recollect the spirit of the debates. And instead of trying what meaning may be squeezed out of the text or invented against it, conform to the probable one in which it was passed.
Wow.
So that that really kind of sums everything up right here. Like, we need to look back at what was the intent, what was going on at the time. We had, like you said, a 95% Christian base. Everything, our government structure was based on biblical principles and God-ordained designs for government. And we need to understand that and look back on that and reference it in the essence and the spirit, and look at the spirit of debates, he says, that we can do by not just reading the Constitution itself, but by understanding the history, by reading letters from our founders, by digging into the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers. There's even, you know, journals from congressional debates that you can get into and what was happening.
Hey, don't forget about listening to our podcast.
There you go. Add that to the list.
Okay.
So kind of wrapping this up here is recollecting the spirit of the debates and really understanding what all of this is built on, and bringing it back. And I guess that's the kind of idea of you mentioned progressivism earlier. Conservatism is to conserve, to keep, to maintain what is good, true, proven, you know, and you know, they call us old fashioned, whatever, but I'm all for it. You know, you have to have a foundation to work on, and you have to understand the foundation, what you're building on, if you want the following structure to last the test of time. So I have one more quote by Noah Webster to kind of finish on here, which kind of also sums up the whole idea of understanding these things. He says, in no country is education so general, in no country have the body of the people such a knowledge of the rights of men and the principles of government. This knowledge, joined with a keen sense of liberty and a watchful jealousy, will guard our Constitution and awaken the people to an instantaneous resistance of encroachments. That's our call to action. That's what we need to do, guys. That's what we need to focus on and work on and maintain it. And in that, just on a basic example, I highly recommend that every American household has a Holy Bible and a copy of our founding documents. With those documents, read the Declaration of Independence every 4th of July. September 17th is the day the Constitution is ratified. It's a great day to read it with your family. The Bill of Rights is ratified December 15th. Read it that day. Just, you know, you can break it up in parts. And then other than that, get yourselves a Noah Webster 1828 dictionary. It is a very powerful tool in combating the ever-shifting sands of our current culture and bringing it back to the bedrock of everything that we're built on and made of. And it's a very strong weapon in your artillery to fight for the future of our country and our posterity, and to protect our God-given liberty.
Christy, all I got to say is, when I was in school, grade school, Mrs. Pasco, one of my teachers, used to make me copy the dictionary as punishment for being the class clown. Okay. I didn't realize what a favor she was doing me.
Right. Good for her.
So nice job, Christy. This was great. You know, there's so much here in this one subject with Noah Webster. I think just maybe just scratched the surface, but we wanted you to know that the meaning, the whole message here is the meaning of words and the meaning of the intent of what was written back then was how we have to interpret the Constitution, and not based on our interpretation today or some other fashion that we might look at this. So nice job, Christy. That was Words Matter. And we are going to be getting into some other neat things as we go along with this podcast. There's so much. Every time Christy and I sit down and talk about, hey, what are we going to do next? It's like we come up with 12 things because there are so many things in the Constitution that are interesting, like this one, that are meaningful and necessary for us to get down a few levels to understand what made this country so great. And so it's a lot of fun, and it's a great educational process to go through. So, Christy, nice job.
Thanks.
Christy Tyrone, I'm Mark DeLuzio, and we'll see you next time.
God bless.
God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God. You can find other episodes on our website at 1787solution.com, YouTube, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're your hosts, Christy Tyrone and Mark DeLuzio. Until next time, may God bless you and may God bless America.